Good morning.
Good morning.
I invite you to join me in the book of Genesis. Open your Bibles to the very first book of the Bible, Genesis. We're going to look at several verses in chapter 12 together in just a moment. Well, over the course of this year, we have been looking at this theme, that the fields are white. This is a phrase that is taken from Jesus' words in John chapter 4, as he tries to instruct his disciples to open up their eyes to the fact that there are all kinds of people who are interested in his message, not just his fellow Jews, not just this very small ragtag group of disciples that followed him around from town to town, but there were many more people, including the Samaritans, who he is among in that chapter, and even the Gentiles, eventually in the far corners of the earth, who will be coming to him. And so I believe, based on lots of things that we read about in the Bible, that the fields are still white for harvest today as they were back then. And if we open our lives up to the Holy Spirit, as the people in Book of Acts did, he will put them on desert roads and in towns and in places where people who are interested in Jesus can connect to him and his gospel message. And so we've been thinking about these things in once-a-month sermons, but we've been also doing different things during the course of this year to try to connect ourselves with people. And so one of you has gone across the street with me to this neighborhood of Teensboro Crossing. We've done a ton of door knocking over there. Several of you have helped out with three different booths, three different town events that we've done in this area to try to connect with people there. Some of you are going to a neighborhood Bible study that I'm hosting in our home on Tuesday nights. And Thursday there's been a study as well. And many of you, even if you haven't participated in the actual events, many of you have done some design work for me. Many of you have done ordering work for me. Many of you have just gone to stores and picked up supplies and donated things, and sometimes yourselves to that work. And I have confidence that many of you have been praying this year for God to bless us with opportunities, and he has. Four different people have come to the Lord this year in our efforts amongst us and somebody even from the community. So Jason Weber was baptized earlier this year, as you know, and Bruno Brito, Alina Shishinsky, Joshua Wolfert. And so I've been just so encouraged by the way that God has worked this year amongst us. All glory be to his name. He is the one that has done this work. He's just used us as his hands and his mouths. And so I hope that you've been encouraged this year by what we've done. I hope that this has energized you and challenged you in your growth in evangelism to understand more deeply your role in it, because all of us do have a role in this work. I've been really trying to stress that this year. This is not a one-man job. If it is, it's going to fail. This is a whole congregation job, and I've been encouraged by the fact that so many of you have pitched in lots of different kinds of ways for this. Let's keep doing that far beyond this year and us talking about this once a month. We started this year with a big picture lesson in John chapter 4, in the whole context of Jesus saying that the fields are white. I'd like to end this year with another big picture lesson about our outward focus, which is connected to Israel's outward focus and God's plan for his spiritual family from the beginning of when he first called Abraham and gave him the promises that he gave him. So I'd like you to go to Genesis 12 with me. I want you to look at Abraham's family mission statement. Genesis 12, verse 1. The Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. And whom dishonors you, I will curse, And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. You know, it's really common for companies and organized groups of people to have some sort of mission statement, because a company or a group of people might do a lot of things, might make a lot of things, might talk to a lot of people, etc., but they need some sort of core understanding of who they are, of why they exist, and of what kind of goal they're trying to work to accomplish. And if you look at a lot of the successful companies in our economy, they have mission statements. Like, here's the one for Tesla. Tesla's mission statement is to accelerate, and that's kind of funny because Tesla makes cars, right? To accelerate the world's transition to sustainable energy. Here's PayPal's mission statement. To build the web's most convenient, secure, cost-effective payment solution. Here's Amazon's mission statement. To be Earth's most consumer-centric company, where customers can find and discover anything they might want to buy online, and endeavors to offer its customers the lowest possible prices. For better or for worse, Amazon is doing a bang-up job fulfilling that mission statement. But mission statements aren't just for companies. They're also for nations. We have a motto ever since 1956, when President Eisenhower signed it into law. Our mission statement as a nation, our motto that is on all of our money, is "In God We Trust." Now, whether or not we actually fulfill that motto as a nation is up for discussion, but that is our national motto. That's our national mission statement. Now, Abraham, in Genesis 12, when God first speaks to him, he didn't have to wonder what his family mission statement was going to be, because God just said, "Here it is. This is you. This is your family. This is what I'm going to accomplish through what I'm going to bless you with." So what is the purpose of Abraham's family? What is God aiming to accomplish by making this man at great length, at great cost, a big family, and giving them this land that he is promising them? Why is he doing all of this? It comes down to this phrase: so that you will be a blessing. In fact, you're going to be such a blessing that, as he says there at the end of verse 3, every nation in the world is going to experience the blessing that you have to offer. And this mission statement is so important that God will actually repeat it 3 times in the book of Genesis to the future generations that come after Abraham. So in chapter 22, when Abraham brings his boy up to the mountain and he almost sacrifices him in Genesis 22, right after that, God tells Abraham, "Okay, so now what I told you back there in chapter 12 is going to happen. It's going to be fulfilled. You will be a blessing to the nations." In chapter 26, when Isaac grows up and he marries Rebekah, he starts a family of his own. In chapter 26, God tells him to not go down to Egypt in a time of famine like his daddy did and got in big trouble for that. Because he reiterates the promise, "You're going to be a blessing to the nations." In chapter 28, that's repeated to Jacob in the next generation as Jacob flees from his home because his brother has a death threat hanging over his head. And so God, in the middle of a field with a stone as his pillow, God tells Jacob, "What I told your grandfather and what I told your father is going to be true of you too. I'm going to use you to bless the nations. That's your family job." So this, clearly this is important, but what does it mean? What is that actually saying, that he's going to be a blessing? What does it mean to be a blessing? I think we need to nail that down a little bit more to really appreciate this. I think the word "bless" is first used in the Bible in Genesis chapter 1, verse 22. When God creates the birds and the fish, it said that he blessed them, and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill up the planet." But he wasn't just going to use that word to talk about the creatures on planet Earth. Several verses later, in chapter 1, verse 28, he blessed Adam and Eve and said the same thing: be fruitful and multiply, and not only fill up the earth, but rule it, subdue it, have dominion over it. So here's the thing. To bless somebody else means two different ideas put together. It means to give somebody a purpose, to give somebody a job to do, but also to give somebody the means or the strength by which to accomplish that purpose. That's what God did with the creatures. That's what God did with Adam and Eve. And that is what God does with Abraham and his family. He gives them the job to do. I want you to be a blessing to the nations. I want you to be faithful members of worshiping me and serving me in this community that I'm building so that you can help these idolatrous, violent nations around you to serve me. And I'm going to give you the strength and the power to fulfill that job. I'm going to give you a strong population. I'm going to give you lands. I'm going to give you homes and vineyards and things to eat and bread in abundance. All these good blessings so that you can use them for the glory of my name. I think it's safe to say that in the history of mankind, no nation on the planet has been formed for this purpose. Nations are founded for the primary benefit of the people who are founding them, or who are starting them. And you only have to go back one page in your Bible to see that. If you go back to the Tower of Babel story in Genesis 11, right before God calls Abram, what do you see people doing? They're building a city. They're building a tall tower that reaches into the heavens. Why? Why are they doing that? To benefit God? To benefit planet Earth? To benefit anybody else besides themselves? No. The text says they're doing that for the glory of their own name, so that we can make a name for ourselves. And God defeats that purpose because that is harmful when human beings decide they want to do that. And in the next chapter, right after that, he says to Abram, I will make your name great. If anybody's going to be making names great, it's me. You don't do that for yourself. I do that for you. And not for yourself, but for the benefit of other people. Israel had tons of prosperity and blessings, but the main reason for their existence was to benefit the globe. Have you ever thought about it in that way? But unfortunately, God's special nation did not fulfill that mission statement very well. Because this family of Abraham was flawed among the nations. And you don't have to read very far past the beginning of Genesis 12 to see that. Because later on, in Genesis 12, there is a famine that strikes the ancient Near East where Abraham lives. And so what he decides to do is, I'm going to take my family, I'm going to go down to the nation of Egypt, because there's always bread down there. Those Egyptians have the Nile River. They're always churning out grain and things with it. So we're going to go down there, we're going to have something to eat. So they go down there, and what Abram does out of fear is he lies about his wife, because Sarah is beautiful. Oh, she's just my sister. So Pharaoh goes, okay, sister, take another one for my harem. But when he does, very soon after that, God strikes the household of Pharaoh with these great plagues. Plagues, Egypt, foreshadowing something else that comes later. And so Pharaoh suffers because of Abraham's decision to sin. And so he doesn't bring a blessing to this other nation. He actually brings a curse because he messed up. Later on in chapter 20, Abram's going to travel to the Philistine territory. He's going to do the same thing again. He's going to lie about his wife. And so Abimelech is going to take Sarah, but he's not going to touch her. But God comes to Abimelech in a dream and says, you are a dead man. And Abimelech says, I haven't done anything to her. I mean, And God says, I know, you were ignorant about all that. And that's why I didn't let you touch her. But you better give that man back his wife. And Abimelech goes, okay, here she is. All right, why did you lie to me? You didn't bring a blessing. You brought a curse upon me and my family because of your sin. Later on in chapter 26, Abraham's boy does the exact same thing his dad did, in the exact same place where his dad did that. So Isaac takes Rebekah and he settles down in Philistine territory, and I imagine that it's another Abimelech who is ruling over the Philistines, but this Abimelech, you know, tries to take Rebekah, or it thinks about it, and so there is this really bad tension there because of Isaac's sin and lying about his wife again. Abimelech says, if someone had touched your wife, you would have brought guilt upon us. But perhaps the very worst example in Genesis of Abraham's family bringing a curse and not a blessing is in chapter 34. Because in chapter 34, what happens is, as a result of Dinah, Jacob's daughter, sleeping with the prince of Shechem, what happens is her brothers decide to take terrible, bloody vengeance into their own hands on the entire city of Shechem. And so what they do is they deceive all of the men of the city of Shechem into circumcising themselves to make them weak and vulnerable and unable to fight their own battles. And then two of the sons of Jacob, the Levi, who would become the family of the high priest and the other priests. So Levi and Simeon, they take swords and they go into Shechem and they kill every last man of the city. And then they loot the entire city. They take all the animals. They take the women. They take all the wives of those men they just killed. They take the kids of all those families and they take them for themselves. Abraham's family was not always a blessing to the other nations. He was a curse sometimes. Now, it wasn't all bad, because if you go to chapter 18, you get the story of Abraham talking to God on behalf of the city of Sodom and trying to make sure that God's threshold for the destruction of that city was really low, or really high, rather, because his nephew was living in that town. And so, please, God, don't destroy all those people. And God gives him grace for that. And so there are stories like that in Genesis. But as we read through this narrative, it gives us pause. And it makes us wonder if this mission statement is actually going to be fulfilled by this family or not. Because some of these stories, it looks like it's not. And that continues through the rest of the Old Testament. So this is just an illustration of the mission statement, that they are to be a blessing to all of these surrounding nations that understand who they are. The Philistines who lives on the coast, the Egyptians down south, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Syrians, all these other countries who knew about Israel. This is who they were to be. And this is why it was such a bad thing for Jonah not to want to go to the Assyrians to preach to them about their sins. It's because that was the whole purpose of Israel, is to be this light. And the prophets talk about how the temple of God was supposed to be a house of prayer for all the nations. But what does Israel do? They turn it into a house of robbers. And that continues even into the New Testament. Jesus talks about that too when he has to go into the temple and clean it up. He says, you guys have forgotten your purpose. You're just here to make a buck off of the poor people around you. And so what Israel actually becomes, rather than going outward, rather than spreading light, is they want to become like all of the nations around them. Rather than being this influence of blessing, they are cursed because the curses and the wickedness of those around them come into them, and they begin to dress like everybody else and talk like everybody else and act like the nations around them and worship their gods instead of helping other people to worship the one and true God of heaven and earth. And so, what is God going to do about that? Well, that's where you get to the end of Genesis. I want you to turn to chapter 41. We're going to read a verse there, but I'm going to set up the story first. So, when you get to Jacob's sons, remember that there is one particular son that really is a burr in the saddle of all the other sons. Nobody can stand Joseph.
He's got dreams. He's the goody-goody boy. He gets daddy's coat. He gets the daddy's favorite place at the table. He's daddy's favorite of all the sons. And so what they do is they take him. They almost kill him. So one pipes up for him and says, no, let's not do that. Let's just make a buck off of him instead, because that's so much better. So let's sell him off into slavery. So what God does with Joseph, even though his life starts out really rocky, God takes Joseph into Egypt and he watches over him, even as he goes through some really difficult situations. But then Joseph winds up right in front of Pharaoh in the throne room of Egypt. And he's explaining to Pharaoh the dreams that Pharaoh is having. And Pharaoh, very wisely, after Joseph says, okay, let me tell you what that means. You dreaming about cows and ears of grain and some devouring some other ones, crazy things like that. Let me tell you what that means. We're going to have 7 really good years, and we're going to have 7 terrible, terrible years of famine. We're all going to starve to death unless we do something about that. So Pharaoh very wisely appoints Joseph as his right-hand guy. And then Joseph starts using the 7 good years to store up all of this grain. Now, what is he going to do with all that grain? Well, when the 7 years of famine hits, Egypt says, we're really hungry. But not just Egypt. Look at this verse. Are you there in the text? Genesis 41, verse 57. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. I want to suggest to you, and I'm sure other people have thought of this before me, but I want to suggest that what we see happening in Joseph's story is some kind of fulfillment early on in the Bible of the mission statement for Abraham's family. That God's going to use this family to be a blessing to the globe. This is a small way in which that happens, is everybody comes to Egypt and there's a son, actually a great-grandson of Abraham, sitting in a high position of power, using his position to help everybody eat food. That's a picture of what's coming in Jesus Christ. And this is a small way that that happens here in the book of Genesis. You look at Joseph's life, God gave him amazing blessings. Gave him a position of power right next to the king. Gave him riches, gave him a wife and a family and all these things. Why? So that Joseph could just sit back and drink lemonade? No, so that Joseph could leverage those blessings to help other people who needed help. That's our job. The focus of Israel is not just a focus for Abraham's family. This is our mission statement too. That's why we're talking about this in such great length. Go over to the book of Acts now. I'm going to show you something in Acts chapter 3. As we move forward to the New Testament and to the sacrifice of Jesus, I want you to notice something here in Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3 is a really neat scene of blessing. Because what we see in Acts 3 is a lame man who's sitting at one of the gates of the temple, Herod's temple. He's been begging alms for a while. He is more than 40 years old. And he's been lame from birth. So my guess is he's been sitting at this beautiful gate for a really long time. But regardless, he's there one day as Peter and John come into the temple. And so Peter and John get his attention. And he looks at them expecting to receive money, like he does from everybody else. But what they give him is a lot better than money. They give him the ability to walk, which he has never enjoyed before, through the name of Jesus. Not because of power within them, but they do this miracle. And so the crowd, who knows this guy, they understand his situation and his background. They gather themselves together at this scene with this guy just jumping and leaping around the place. And Peter then now has an audience to preach a sermon. And so he does. And the sermon that he preaches in Acts 3 is a lot like the sermon that he preaches in Acts 2. He preaches about Jesus, that God foreknew what would happen to his son when he sent him into the world. You guys killed him. You're guilty of deicide, of killing God. But what God is going to do is he's going to use that death as a way of saving you all, of turning you from your wickedness so that you can receive blessings. Notice
the text, Acts chapter 3, verse 25. As he connects these people to their past, he makes this point: you are the sons of the prophets and of the covenant that God made with your father, saying to Abraham, there's the mission statement, in your offspring shall the families of the earth be blessed. So the purpose of Israel didn't die with the failures of God's nation in the Old Testament. Not at all. It didn't die at all. It is picked back up again by Jesus and his people. That's so neat to me. And so the Jews and the Gentiles who follow Jesus can get this ball that Israel dropped. And that's amazing considering who we are, isn't it? Because just like the family of Abraham was flawed among the nations that they were supposed to be a blessing to, we could also make the same point about the family of Jesus. From the beginning, we're flawed among the nations. You know, you think about how Paul tells us that the church is built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets. But what were the apostles like as they were following Jesus around? Were they always good and kind and sweet and unselfish and giving? They had constant arguments about who's the best, who's the greatest, who's Jesus' favorite. Even at the Lord's Supper table, they're arguing about that kind of nonsense. And they really struggled with racism. You ever thought about that? You know, even after Peter goes to the house of Cornelius, after God painstakingly shows him it's okay to convert this guy and his family, his household. Even after that, we read about in the book of Galatians, Paul walks into a room, and Peter is refusing to sit down at the same table with Gentile Christians who haven't been circumcised because of a peer pressure situation. And Paul has to say, what in the world is going on here? This is racism, and it's wrong, and it's anti-gospel. Fix that, Peter. So you had situations like this going on amongst these churches and these people. And so we can make this point, not just about the apostles and the prophets and the leadership of the New Testament, but even if you look at our lives today, you're going to see weaknesses. It's true of me. You're going to see weaknesses. You're going to see contradictions. In other words, you're going to see sin. The scripture that I put up on the board in James chapter 3, verse 2, James says, we all stumble in many ways. And in that context, he's talking about the way that we use our language. Has anybody in here ever used your words to sin against God and your fellow man? Yeah, oh yeah. I think all of us have. Because he says in that context, the tongue, nobody can tame it. It's this restless evil full of deadly poison. So it is amazing to me that the Lord is compassionate and merciful to use us. Because none of us can hold ourselves up as morally superior to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the Israelites of the Old Testament. Oh, I'm so glad we're so much better than they are. We're not. We're not. And we shouldn't think of ourselves that way. And the point of all this is not to spread gloom and doom. The point of this is to highlight the power and the love of God that He chooses, despite our flaws that we still have. He chooses to use us still. And so our weaknesses show that the power of salvation is not in us, And the grace that we receive, it shows other people when they see that in us, what Christianity is all about. So don't be afraid to let other people see your flaws. To see who you really are. They're going to see your mistakes, but if you are somebody who's walking in the light, they're going to see someone who is glorifying God, who's relying on Him to cover our mistakes and our weaknesses and our sin. That's what the gospel is all about. I love that phrase in the song that we sometimes sing. Each can his brother's failings hide and show a brother's love. Not that we're excusing sin. That's blessed be the tie binds, by the way. Not that we're excusing sin in each other or the world, but our mission is to be a blessing to other people, which means that we draw people to the light. We don't wag a finger in their faces and condemn them without hope. So we're flawed among the nations, but the Son that we serve is the one through Abraham's family that all nations are blessed through. If you look at Acts chapter 3, if you're still there, look at the next verse. Past verse 25, verse 26 says, God, having raised up His servant, sent Him to you first to, notice what it says, to bless you by turning every one of you from your wickedness. So Peter picks this up, what's been spoken to Abraham, and he reiterates it and says, that's what we're all about now, is he wants to bless you so that you can bless other people. And he's using language, when he talks about Jesus as a servant, he is reiterating what Isaiah said in his prophecies about this servant who's going to come and suffer terrible things on behalf of the sins of other people. This is chapter 53 and other places in the book of Isaiah. And that is upside down logic to us. And to the Jews, because if you're hanged on a tree, according to the law of Moses, you are cursed. That is bad for you and for other people to see that. But God says, no, God took that scene of cursing and He made it into a scene of blessing, because that is the key that unlocks the door for life. For everybody who sees that and goes to it. And so that's what evangelism is all about at its heart. Evangelism is about not just the craft of trying to say things in a winsome way for other people. Evangelism is even more about care, compassion, to want to do for other people what Jesus has done for us. And to be a part of that work of proclaiming to people who haven't heard it yet. So what I want to do is, I want to go back as we end to a verse in 1 Peter 2 that I've highlighted several times in the last month or so about what he says our mission as Christians is all about. Peter, who went a long time before learning this himself, he says this: you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for His own possession. Why? What's the mission? That you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. We need to appreciate the ancient and noble role that all of us step into when we are baptized into Christ and we put on His name. This is who we are and what we do. This is why we come together to remember the feast that we're about to partake of, that goes back to the very first time it was given at that supper table in Jerusalem, as Jesus, who is hours before His death, looks at His guys and says, do you realize what I'm doing here? I am about to sacrifice myself. My own body? I'm going to shed my own blood. I'm going to get speared. I'm going to get nailed to a piece of wood, and that blood's going to come pouring out of my body. Why? So that you guys could have life. Be a blessing. don't just enjoy the blessings that God gives to you. God, help us if we don't pour them out as we have been blessed. So this is a reminder not just of what Jesus did for us, but also of the fact that we are to act as He acted, to do what He did in giving up our lives for the benefit of the other people around us, inside of this church and outside of this church. So let's remember that as we take supper together.